In a previous life, I used to write enterprise firmware for HDDs and SSDs, and now it's my life mission to remove those from all systems I touch. This is my obligatory dog tax. Stick around, there'll be more later. This is my dog, Turing. So today, I'm going to talk about why our company is building a database, what wasn't working with the first database we built, how we decided to re-architect it, and then the open source projects that we built it upon. So first of all, why are we building a database? There's a lot of really good databases out there. Why didn't we use just one of those? Well, there's a lot of reasons. One of them being we didn't want to be tied to certain licenses that might change out from under us and or billing that might change. It became a business decision. But we also thought, because what we're doing is a little unique, not all of the off-the-shelf databases fit our needs. We're building a database for continuous profiling. So continuous profiling is, is the process of capturing stack traces off of the CPU, storing those in a database, and then allowing users to query back that data over time. This allows them to answer questions like, why is my application slow? What is the most expensive function across my entire infrastructure? Or why does this user have a worse experience on our system than any of the other users? So the goals of our database were we needed it to be easy to operate. We're a really small company. We don't have a huge team, so it needed to be simple. We needed to be cost-effective at scale. We are trying to build a business, so we needed it to scale cost-wise with customers. And then we really wanted our storage and compute to be decoupled. That way, reads don't affect our write path and vice versa. So this is our first attempt at a profiling database. It was a database for stacks. So what this means is we check the stack trace on the CPU, we record all the functions we see on that stack trace, and we record the timestamp and the values that we see for that. So this gives us a really specific data shape. The data is repeated. We see the same functions called over and over. They're deeply nested, so function A calls function B calls function C and D, and so on. The data is also immutable. Once we've recorded a stack trace, it doesn't really make sense for a user to ask to update it, because it's just a snapshot of what happened on your CPU. It's temporal, so we're just capturing the data at a specific time. It's also non-relational. One stack trace doesn't necessarily refer to another. And importantly, it also has dynamic columns. So you might be more familiar with this as known as labels in the metrics or log world, where you can label your data sets, where it came from, what runtime it was using, what user ID is attached to the stack trace, things like that. And the last thing is not necessarily a data shape, but how the data comes in. This type of data is really write dominated. You might have a cluster of 1,000 nodes shipping profiling data to you, but you probably only query that data once a day, twice a day. It's user driven, so it's just going to be naturally more write dominated. So this lends itself really well to columnar, and thank you for Matt Topol for pointing out Apache Arrow. That's typically half the story. Apache Arrow is really good for that transfer format, the in-memory format. But then there's its companion piece, the file storage for it, is the de facto standard being Apache Parquet. So this stores all the data in columnar format, and we get really good compression out of it, which is really important for our repeated, nested, immutable data. So this is where we came up with FrostDB. It's written in Go. It's backed by Arrow and Parquet. It was built on top of an LSM-ish tree. I say LSM-ish because, again, our database is immutable, so we don't actually need to deal with updates or deletes. So it basically just looks like we have a bunch of Arrow records in memory as we receive them. Once we accumulate enough of those, we can pack them into Parquet files. Once we accumulate those, we can pack those Parquet files into one just big chunkier Parquet file and ship it off to object storage. So great, we had a database. We built one for the enterprise scale. We basically sharded out a bunch of FrostDB instances. Writes came in, they'd get split across a bunch of instances. Reads would just fan in from those instances. And then we used preemptible instances to keep our costs really low. So this is great. We had a database that was easy to manage, it scaled, and it was working. And then we had customers, and they ruined it. So our customers ended up growing bigger. They started using more and more of our database, which was good. But we got to a point where we were unable to write out our memory in time for preemption. So we had preemptible instances. We'd get notified it was going to be shut down. We try to write it out, but we had so much data in memory that we couldn't get it there in time. We could have solved this by scaling out the number of instances further, but now suddenly our cloud bill just skyrocketed and we're not accomplishing our goals. So we reached into every database developer's toolkit and we added a write-ahead log for durability. So now writes are written to the write-ahead log on a persistent disk, then they can be acknowledged to the clients. Great. We no longer need to write out our data when we're preempted. We can just shut down, come back up, replay the wall, carry on from where we left off. Everything's working again. Now we've coupled compute and storage a little bit, but it's not too bad. And those damn customers. So because we're replaying a wall, our customers noticed that when that was happening, their data was no longer available. We couldn't answer a query because we hadn't replayed it from the write-ahead log. All right. Well, fair enough. We have to go back and start replicating the writes. So now each of our FrostDB instances sees a copy of the write. Technically, we're triplicating the writes. But now when we're replaying the wall, customers can read their data because they'll just get it from a different node that isn't currently replaying. Great. Happy customers again. We have availability. We're not losing data. OK, but we did just increase our cost a little bit because now we have 3 times the data footprint. All right. Well, it's working, except for those damn customers. Now we have long replays caused because our customers' footprint grew so big on the nodes that the nodes just become really out of date after their replay. So if a replay took 10 minutes, that node wasn't receiving writes for 10 minutes. And so now it's 10 minutes behind the other nodes and can't answer queries again. So yet again, we have to make changes to our system. And we had replay coordination. So now when a node comes up, it replays at wall. It talks to the other node, says, hey, how far behind I am. They say, these are the writes you're missing. You're this far behind. They send them over. Great. The node replays those writes from the other nodes. And now it's caught back up and is a fully functioning node in the system again. Hooray. We're back to a working system. But if you haven't gotten the gist of my talk, it's those damn customers again. So some of those customers get so big that it created really complex failure scenarios. So one of the things we saw was we'd have a node that would go down, come back up, replay its wall, request a bunch of data. It took so long to replay its wall, it got really far behind. The data it requested was too much for the node to handle, so it killed. Kubernetes reschedules it, it comes back, now it's further behind, and you can see where this goes because it requests more data, crashes, cycles. It's a vicious cycle. Often what would happen is that node would be doing that so long, another node would go down, and then it would just create this cascading failure where suddenly our whole database was down. So one of my favorite systems quotes is every system is perfectly designed to get the results that it does. So we had perfectly designed our system to be challenging to operate, expensive at any scale, and we had hard dependencies between storage and compute. We're awesome. So clearly none of our architecture goals were being met. It was time for a new architecture. So this is where Apache Data Fusion comes in. This is the first thing we reached for. We learned when we were making FrostDB that creating your own query engines, really hard to get it right. It's really hard to get it fast. And we really didn't want to invest all of our time again in building that. So we reached for something open source. Data Fusion is really fast. It's written in Rust. It's columnar by default. It's very extensible, and it works with many table formats out of the box. So it didn't really lock us into what the rest of our database could look like, but it was going to give us really free performance. So we were really excited about that. So we decided to move forward with Data Fusion and writing our new database in Rust. The second thing we reached for on the right path was Delta Lake. So Delta Lake was donated by Databricks, so open source community. It's an open table format, much like Apache Iceberg. It provides ACID transactions, really fast writes, quick reads through file pruning, and schema evolution, which is, again, really important for our database because of the labels we see. We don't know the schema beforehand. So great. So our database looks like this right now. We have clients writing Arrow. The Arrow gets written to Parquet as object storage and then committed to the Delta log. The only problem with this is a rather expensive architecture. Remember, you might have thousands of nodes, each of those representing a client, all writing to the tables. This creates, you know, one Parquet file for write and then a commit per write, so huge write amp. Becomes really expensive. Most cloud providers bill you for every write you do. So kind of an expensive database to operate. So we inject a buffered writer. So Because it's an observability database, usually you don't need to see your data within sub-second intervals. So basically what we did is we no longer acknowledge a write to the client until it's buffered in this buffered writer and then is flushed to the object storage. Once it's fully committed to the log, then we'll acknowledge the client. So usually it's however long it takes up to fill a pre-configured buffer size, or 1 second, however long that takes. So there's a 1 second delay in being able to read the data you write, but clients don't care that they can't see the last sub-second of data. So great. This is a lot less expensive to operate because now we have larger files and fewer writes to the system. The problem with this is, if you notice, we have lots of clients from different customers all being shoved into a single table. So now, if we have a really big client, it can affect the reads for other smaller clients because you have to first sift through that big client's data to get at the data you want. So now we have this weird paradigm where one customer can kind of ruin the query experience for other customers. So this is where we add a compactor and tenant tables. So it's just Delta Lake again, but now once a customer hits a pre-configured size in the primary table, we basically slurp all that data up, write a new bigger Parquet file in a different Delta table that's just for that tenant, and we keep really good performance. So now when a read happens, they just have to get their reads from the primary table, which is kept rather small, and then their reads from their tenant table. So great. This is working really well. It's really simple to operate. You'll notice we have very few moving pieces. We have no disks, thank goodness. Everything's working great. But one thing we noticed, and one of the cool things about building a profiling database, is you get to profile your own database. So as we were doing this, we're learning, hey, we're spending an inordinate amount of time converting Parquet to Arrow every time we need to move data or read data. There's a huge serialization cost. We also noticed it with Delta Lake, that the normal commit log is all written in JSON. And sure, JSON serialization can be fast, but when you do it a ton, that ends up being a huge footprint for your CPU. So shout out to our friends at SpiralDB for their open file format called Vortex. So Vortex offers zero copy reads for Apache Arrow. So basically, we no longer have to serialize the data when we write all our Arrow records to files, and we don't have to deserialize it when we read it back into memory. So we actually replaced all the JSON files, as well as all of our Parquet files, with Vortex. This gave us faster queries, zero copy reads, which gave us lower memory overhead. And the one thing we're really excited about is it's an extensible file format, so we can bring our own encoding schemes. We haven't done this yet, but there's a lot of room to grow there in terms of query performance for profiling data. So now we have an easy to operate database. It's really cost effective at scale. The storage and compute are completely decoupled. Overall, from our FrostDB database to this one, this has got us a 50% reduction in cost. We've increased or decreased our query latency by over 200%, and we no longer have data unavailability. So big shout out to all the open source projects that made this possible. We literally just built on top of all these things, which is pretty cool to go from zero to a database in just a year's time with these awesome projects. Last dog tags. All right. Any questions? Yeah. What?
So you create database and then replace it with a capital open source component. So there is no more database.
Correct. FrostDB is no longer anywhere under the hood.
So you build database and delete it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so the question was, did we consider other table formats? So yeah, we looked at basically the big three, which is, you know, Iceberg, Delta Lake, and that third weird one I can't remember the name of. Hootie, thank you. What a weird name. Okay, yeah, so we looked at that, and one of the things that really stood out for Delta Lake was the way it handled writes. Because our workload is so write-dominated, and we need to get really fast writes in there, and because we pay our cloud provider for every write we do to object storage, we wanted something that has the smallest amount of write amplification and that can do writes the fastest. So a typical Delta Lake write only requires you to write a single commit file. So it's a single write, potentially with a checkpoint. But it's a single write for most writes. So that was really advantageous for our type of database, whereas Apache Iceberg is usually like two or three different writes because you have to update manifests and then the commit version and stuff. So that was why we picked that.
But is a buffer, that doesn't make sense.
Say that again?
Is a buffer in front of the
Yeah, I think it does make a difference because that's, sorry, yes. So the question was, even with the buffered writes in front of the database, does it make sense between which open table format? And we think it still makes a big difference because it's still one write versus three every time we flush that. Any other questions? All right, in the back, you gotta be loud. So there's a lot of cost factors in our old database. So one of them is we had to triplicate the data. So now we have all of these extra nodes that we have holding onto this data. We had to add disks to all of those nodes because we had a write ahead log. Disk cost money. So we had to deal with that. And those are kind of our big primary factors was our compute and our disk storage. I think I'm probably missing some other things. I think our networking was also a cost because we were triplicating the data across regions. So our network bandwidth actually ended up being quite expensive for that as well. Yeah, so faster is kind of two really big components. One of them being that data fusion was better than our Go implementation of a query engine.